Greetings, everyone. Whoa, that was loud. Wow, I hope I didn't wake anybody up. Or if, I hope you did. I hope I didn't startle anyone. Wow, that's terrific. Welcome to the third Sunday in Advent. We're so happy to see all of you. Great to have the youth here, the high schoolers, and middle school, is that right? We have some middle schoolers? Terrific. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Today we are blessed with Maria Lobiondo, one of our regulars here at Adult Education, especially around the time of Advent, to share with us a story, and we're so happy to have her. I'll introduce her in a few moments, but first, let's start off with a prayer. Please pray with me. Holy God, thank you for this time together. Thank you for authors and storytellers. Thank you for Maria Lobiondo's willingness to share her gifts with us. May we listen and learn as you show us the way. In your name we pray, amen. So today, Maria will be sharing the story Tolstoy's Two Old Men. Where are you on life's pilgrimage? Maria Lobiondo believes that a story is a heart-to-heart gift shared between teller and listener. She began practicing the oral tradition of storytelling when expecting her second child. Her daughter is now 30 years old. She has shared folk and literary tales several times for Nassau Presbyterian's Advent programs, as well as locally in schools, other religious settings, and festivals. And we're so happy to have her return to us today. Please give a warm welcome to Maria Lobiondo.
Okay, how's that?
Good,
good. Well, as I said to Marshall and to Virginia, this is a special gift to me because the stories that I get to share with you are not stories I get to tell in many other settings. So for me, this is a very special gift to be able to come and be with you today. The story of two old men is one of Tolstoy's religious stories, and it is very long. I think when I downloaded it from the internet, it was like 22 pages. Now, usually storytellers memorize a literary tale, but I knew there was no way I was going to be able to memorize 22 pages. So, what I have for you is kind of my version of the story with the, hopefully, the essence of what Tolstoy was trying to get across within the story. And again, because it is so long, to give us all a little break from hearing a lot of words, I have some humming interludes, as if that's the break in a chapter. Tolstoy does break it down into something like 20 chapters. No, we'll have some interludes in between just to kind of give ourselves a little break and hopefully to allow you to picture what is going on, to make images in your minds of the characters and what they're experiencing. And then when we're all done, hopefully there will be time for any comments, any questions. I don't guarantee I have all the answers, especially because I'm not a Tolstoy scholar, but I will do my best to answer your questions. And that will be our time together. Sound good? Okay. We are pilgrims on a journey. We are travelers on the road. We are here to help each other walk the mile and share the load. There were two old men, peasants, and together they had made a vow to go to the Holy Land on pilgrimage before they died. One was Efim. Efim was a rich peasant. He was an upright and strict man. had a long beard, he was tall, he had a large family that he took care of. He did not smoke a pipe, he did not take snuff, he did not drink, he did not use foul language. He had been a village elder twice and left the village in good financial shape. He was a strict man. His companion was Elisha. Elisha was neither rich nor poor. He had been a traveling carpenter in his younger days. Both men were nearing 70. Elisha now stayed closer to home as a beekeeper. And Elisha did take snuff and smoke now and again. And he did like a drink now and again. He liked to sing. He was very cheerful. And people liked to have him around. He was as bald as they say the prophet Elisha is bald, and that's who he was named for. And he had a dark, curly beard. He was a little bit shorter than Ephim. But the two of them were friends. One day, Elisha went to Ephim and said, "Friend, when are we going to make good on our pilgrimage? We are not getting any younger." "Oh, Elisha, I have started to build a hut. And what I thought would only take 100 rubles is taking 3 times as much. I must see it through. You know I am a man who must see a job through to the end. But when the hut is done, we will go." "No, Ephim, now is the time to go. You could ask your son to oversee the hut. It is spring. Now is the time to go." "My son is, I don't feel he is trustworthy enough to see the job through." "Ephim, when we are gone, our families will have to carry on without us anyway. Give your son this opportunity, this experience." "Well, how are we to raise the money? We will need at least 100 rubles each. How will you get that?" "How will I get that? Well, you have 10 times as much money as me, and you are worried about money? Just say that we will go, and I will sell some of my hives. There is a neighbor who has been asking. And if that is not enough, I will go to my family. I will get the money. Just say that we will go." Well, that night, Ephim thought about what Elisha had said, and he thought, he is right. So he went to Elisha the next day and said, "All right, we will go. Start to make preparations." And so they did. For Ephim, it was not hard to raise the 100 rubles. Elisha went to the neighbor, and he sold some of his hives, and he was able to raise 70 rubles. So then he went to his family. His wife gave him all that she had saved for her own funeral. And then, to make up the difference, his daughter-in-law gave him the rest. With the 100 rubles set aside, the next preparations began. They had to have good leather boots, another pair of shoes, a backpack, a walking stick, a cloak to wear, and cakes and breads for at least the first part of the journey. When all this was prepared, the families and some of the village friends walked Ephim and Elisha to the edge of the village, and Ephim and Elisha welcomed the open road. The first part of the journey was easy. The miles seemed to flow by. The people where they went were generous in giving them a place to stay and feeding them so that they didn't have to spend very much of their money at all. they made about 500 miles south. And this is how they traveled well. But then they came to the area that we now know as Ukraine. And there had been a famine there. They noticed immediately that the landscape changed and that the people were less open, less welcoming, gaunt. Now, when they first came there, the people were more than welcoming as far as having them stay overnight, but not quite so welcoming in feeding them. And so they found that they had to spend some of their money for bread. It came to a point where they thought, the further south we go, the more difficult it's going to be to find food. And so at one point, they bought about 15 pounds of bread, hardtack bread, that would need to be soaked in water in order to eat it. But they piled that in their backpacks so that they would not be without food. Now, they had left in the spring, and it was summertime now, and getting hot. So what Efim and Elisha would do is get up sometimes before dawn so that they could get their miles in the coolest part of the day. And then when the sun was high and it was hot, they would take a break. And after that, find a place to stay for the night. Well, it happened on one particular day that Efim, who was the better walker, wanted to keep going, and it was hot. And Elisha was having a hard time keeping up. And he wanted a drink of water, but Efim did not want to stop. Oh, come, friend. I will stop here at this homestead and just beg some drink there, and then I will catch up with you. Very well. And Efim kept walking. Elisha turned to the homestead. It was very quiet there and run down. The plaster on the side of the hut was all crumbling. The thatch on the roof at the top in one place looked like it was caving in. And there was no sign of life around. Elisha opened the gate, and he went to the door and knocked. Hello, a pilgrim here, please, some water. No answer. Thought that strange, so he tried again. Please, good Christians, please, a pilgrim here asking for water. Still no answer. Well, this is very unwelcoming. I'll try one more time. Good Christians, please, a drink of water. And from inside the hut, he heard a moan. Someone needs help. He tried the door. It opened easily. He went inside. It was dark, dusty, and there was a foul smell coming toward him. When his eyes adjusted, he saw, sitting near a table, an old woman about his age, and in front of her, a boy with a distended stomach, whimpering, "Bread, Granny, bread, bread." He looked around, and there on the floor by the hearth was a woman. Her legs were flopping back and forth, and it was from her that the foul smell was coming from, for she was very sick, but no one had attended her. As he stood there, figuring out what he would do, a man came into the hut, obviously the master of the house, but he was leaning against the walls to keep upright, and then he fell. The old woman said, "Stranger, what do you want? You see how desperate we are here. We're just waiting for death to take us from hunger." I came to beg a drink. We do not even have the strength to take you to the well. Show me where the bucket is, and I will get the water. And the man pointed to where the bucket was and where the well was, which was far from the hut. Elisha went, he filled the bucket, he came back into the hut, set it down on the dirty table, and then loosed his backpack and took out one of the loaves that he had in it. He began to cut a slice. The eyes on the boy grew large. Elisha offered it first to the master of the house, but he shook his head no and pointed to the boy. And when Elisha gave the slice to the boy, he buried his face in it, gnawing at the hard bread. Then Elisha found a bowl and he put some water in it and began to soften it to give it to the man and the old woman and the woman on the floor. He knew he could not leave them that way, and so he stayed. And over their eating of some bread, they told him their story. We were well enough until the crop failed. That was last spring, and we held out as long as we could. And after we had used all our stores, well, we went to our neighbors, and they were generous enough, but then they became desperate as well and could not share with us anymore, and so we began to sell our things. We had to sell everything, pots and pans, our tools. And when that was gone, we went to the landowner and we remortgaged the land. But then we had nothing and were reduced to eating grass. And I think it was the grass that made my wife sick. Now we just sit here waiting for death to take us. Well, Elisha thought, I cannot leave them like this. And so he let the family stay in the hut and he went and slept outside under the stars. And the next morning he got up and he went into the village and he bought millet and salt and flour and what was needed to make a generous soup to strengthen the family. And then he came back, he cut firewood and he cleaned off the table so he could make the soup and put it on the stove. He had to go to one of the neighbors to borrow a pot. And when the soup was on the stove, he started cleaning, doing the housework that they were not strong enough to do. And then that night they shared the soup, and Elisha listened as they talked some more. And he went out again the next night to sleep under the stars. And again, a third night, he did the same. Now he wanted to catch up with Ephraim, but he did not feel he could leave the family like this. And the next day was a feast day. Well, I will go to Mass for the feast day and I will cook them a good meal. And then I will go and catch up with Ephraim. And that is what he did. He went to Mass, came back, cooked a good meal. And by this time, they were regaining their strength. The grandmother was able to make some fresh bread for the family, and everyone was doing better. And they were doing so well that the master serf decided to go and beg the landowner for mercy to be able to try to sow the crops again. But he came back dejected because the landowner had said, pay me the money first. Now there was no way that he could pay any money if he could not sow the crops. Someone else would do that, and they would be left in the same state that Elisha had found them. What was he to do? He was of two minds. He thought, well, I really have to go and catch up with Ephraim. After all, this is my vow. I cannot break this vow. But what will become of this family? If I don't help, they will fall into the same state I found them in. He could not decide, and as he lay under the stars, he could not find sleep. And then, toward dawn, he had a vision of himself getting up and walking to the gate. And when he got to the gate and tried to open it, he felt a tugging, at his leg, and when he looked down, it was the boy. And the boy was saying, "Grandfather, grandfather," for the boy had begun to call him that and was following him around as a puppy those last days to help out any way he could. And Elisha felt himself look back at the hut, and there was the serf and the grandmother looking out the window with wide eyes. And Elisha heard himself in the dream say, "What good is it for me to go across the sea to seek Christ if I lose Christ here in my soul?" And he knew what he must do. He got up in the morning, he went to the landowner, he paid the debt on the land, then he went into the village and he bargained for a horse and cart. He bought a scythe, since they had sold all their tools and would not be able to cut the grain without it. He bought some flour, and he was going to buy a cow so that the boy would have some milk, but he overheard two women. Now, their dialect was different, but he could make out what they were saying. They say that he was just an ordinary man, a pilgrim who came by, asking for water. But then he began to buy food for them and feed them and clean for them, all kinds of things. Yes, I hear he even bought a horse this morning for them. Some say he's an angel in disguise. Oh, I would like to meet this pilgrim. So would I. Hearing this, Elisha became frightened, and he did not want to be thought of this way. And so he did not buy the cow. He got into the horse and cart, and he brought it back to the homestead. And when he drove it in, the serf's eyes grew so wide, hoping it was for him, but not wanting to assume. And Elisha slid off the cart and said, "Yes, well, it was going cheap, so I bought it. But it will need some grass to eat if you can get that for the horse. And there's some flour if you could bring the sack in." And of course, the serf did all of this. And then Elisha again shared a meal with the family and went to sleep outside. But well before dawn, he got up, put on his pack, got his walking stick, and very quietly went out the gate. He walked and walked in that morning air until he came to a tree. The sun was up by then. It was beginning to get hot. He sat down under the tree and took out his purse to see how much money he had left. 17 rubles and 20 kopecks. "This will not get me over the sea, barely get me home. Now, it looks like friend Efim will have to light a candle for me, and I will hope that a merciful God will understand that I am not going to be able to meet my vow." He put his purse away, and he turned toward home. Well, somehow, the walking was not so difficult anymore. He made a large circle around the homestead and the village because he did not want anyone to see him. And the miles seemed to go so quickly as he walked toward home. He made it in such an easy time. And the harvest had just been brought in when he got there. And everyone was so surprised to see him. "You made it to the Holy Land and back already?" "No, no. I lost my money along the way and I had to turn back. But Efim will make the pilgrimage." The village people gossiped. How could someone as practical as Elisha have lost his money along the way? But after a while, they forgot about it. And Elisha's family, they were so happy to have him home, they did not mind at all. Meanwhile, Efim had walked on, and because it was hot, he too had taken a break under a tree by the road, and sitting there, had fallen asleep. And when he woke up, the day was coming to an end, and he thought, oh, how come Alicia did not wake me up? He must have gone on thinking I did. And Efim walked into the village and asked everywhere, have you seen a man a little shorter than me, bald, dark, curly beard? But no one had seen him. Efim found a place to stay, and that night he thought, now, what should I do? Should I go back to the homestead? No going back. Must go forward. Certainly I will meet Efim on the road, Alicia on the road. And if not on the road, then when we get to Odessa, to take the ship to the Holy Land. And so that is what Efim did. He walked on and on. And when he was close to Odessa, the port city, he met up with a monk who said that he had just come from the Holy Land, and he would be glad to be a guide for Efim and show him all the places to go and what he should do. And so they became companions all the way to Odessa. When they got to Odessa, the monk said, I can tell you a way to book passage without having to pay. No, I will not do anything illegal. I have planned for this. I have the rubles to book passage to the Holy Land and back, and to pay for my passport as well. And so Efim did. He booked his passage, but they could not take off immediately. The weather was not good. And so he had to wait 3 days to board the ship that was filled with cargo. And when he did, he found a choice spot on the deck that he did not want to give up for the entire trip. Even though at one point it rained and the wind and the rain lashed at him, Efim was not going to give up that spot. The monk stayed close to Efim's side, and finally they made it to Jaffa, which is today part of Tel Aviv. And then they were some 70 miles from Jerusalem. Oh, they disembarked. There were many pilgrims, and they joyously made that trek to Jerusalem. When they arrived, it was too late to go to any mass, and they went to the Patriarchate, the Greek Orthodox Patriarchate, and there they were welcomed with a meal, and then the head monk told them to take off their boots, and he washed their feet. After that, they went to the Russian hostel to sleep, and the next morning got up to go to mass at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, the place where it is said that Jesus rose from the dead. And when they got there, there was a Latin mass going on, and they had to wait. So many pilgrims. Oh, they were from all over. Turks, Syrians, Armenians, all over. And Efim waited, and finally, a mass of pilgrims came out, and a mass of pilgrims crushed into the church. Oh, Efim was squished between so many people. He tried to get near the altar, but he could not. And while he was trying to say his prayers, he looked up. And there at the altar was a man, bald head, curly dark beard. He was bowing to the front, bowing to the side. It was Alicia. How did Alicia get there? Well, he wasn't on the same ship from Odessa, and they had said that the ship before had left a week earlier. And he wasn't in the Russian hostel. How did Alicia get there? Well, Efim thought, I will make my way to the door and greet my friend when he comes out. But there were so many pilgrims that by the time Efim made it to the door, Alicia was nowhere to be found. Now, that monk pilgrim, that next night in the Russian hostel, began to go through his things and then yelled out, oh, someone has stolen my rubles. Efim became suspicious. He had lent this monk a ruble that he had not paid back, and he had not seen the monk spend a single ruble the whole time he had been with him. Was this monk going to steal from him? He quickly took his purse. His money was there, but from that time on, he kept feeling for his purse, kept putting his arm on the strings to make sure that it was there. And even when he was trying to pray, thoughts of his money kept coming to mind. The monk after that seemed to disappear. And Efim went to all the holy places that he was supposed to go to. And he went several more times to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And each time, up at the altar, there was Elisha, arms outstretched, praying, the light from the lamps beating down on his bald head, making it shine. And he looked beatific, so peaceful. And Efim could not figure it out, this mystery. And each time he tried to find Elisha afterwards, but he could not. He had made some acquaintance with the other people who had been on the boat from Odessa, and with them he did all the things one is supposed to do on pilgrimage. He bought the candles. He had his parents' names inscribed in books so prayers would be said for them. He visited Bethlehem. He visited Bethany. He visited all the places he was supposed to do on pilgrimage. After 6 weeks, it was time to go home. And so Efim reversed course, walked back to Yafo, made it back to Odessa, and began the long trek back home. He decided that he would stop at that homestead where he had separated from Elisha on the way back. But when he got there, it looked very different. Oh, the hut had been plastered. The roof on the thatch was good. And when he came up to the gate, a boy came running out saying, "Grandfather, grandfather, come, stay with us, stay with us." And a man came from around the side of the hut, obviously the boy's father, and said, "Yes, pilgrim, please, let us give you hospitality. Please come and stay with us." So Efim did. He went in, and he was served a meal. And while he was served a meal, he heard what had happened. Oh, he was an ordinary man, about your age, and he came looking for water, but he found us in a desperate state. We were dying of hunger. But do you know, he gave us bread. He bought food for us. He chopped wood. He cleaned the house. He put us on our feet. He even redeemed our land so that we could get on our feet again. We don't even know his name. But we have decided that any pilgrim who comes by here, we will offer hospitality. That is our only way to thank him. Well, that night, Efim found it difficult to go to sleep, thinking about what he had heard. And finally, he said to himself, "I do not know if my pilgrimage is accepted by God, but Elisha's certainly was." And in the morning, he got up and completed the journey back to his village. And when he got there, well, everyone was glad to see him, and they said, "Oh, you know, Elisha's been here for months." "Oh, is that so?" And then he went to see how his family had done while he was gone. Not so well. His son had not put the potato crop in right, and that hut, well, it had cost even more money to get the thatch on right of that new hut. And Efim found himself filled with anger. When his anger died down, Efim decided to go visit Elisha. And he met his wife first. "Oh, you are back. Oh, safe journey, I hope. It was a good pilgrimage." "Well, we have had our man back for several months now. He said that he lost his money on the way, but he won't say anything more about it. But we don't care. We are glad to have him back. He's out with his bees. I will take you to him. And she guided him to the meadow where Elisha was, arms outstretched with the bees flying about him, the sun beating down on his head, looking like Ephraim had seen him in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And when Elisha saw Ephraim, well, he got the bees back in the hive, and then he said, "Friend, you have made it back. That is so good. Here's a bench. Come, sit. Tell me all about your pilgrimage." And Ephraim sat down, and he started to talk, and he tried to bring up the conversation about the homestead. "No, no, no. God's business. God's business. No, no, I won't talk about it. Now, tell me some more." And Ephraim did, and he kept trying to bring the conversation back to the homestead and the people there. But every time he did, Elisha said, "No, no, God's affairs, God's business. No, I won't talk of it." Until finally, Ephraim sighed. He knew he was not going to get Elisha to talk about that family. And he did not want to ask Elisha about the visions in Jerusalem. Instead, he understood something deeper about pilgrimage and about life's journey and about how all of us must travel with love and do good works. We are pilgrims on a journey. We are travelers on the road. We are here to help each other, share the mile, and share the load.
Thank you, Maria Lobiondo, for that wonderful story. Does anyone have a question or a comment?
That was incredible. I'm really curious, though, about how you go about reconstructing a story like that. What's your process?
For this story, especially because it was so long, I read it many times. There are also versions where you can hear it, you know, YouTube. Oh, what do we do before YouTube? I don't know. But, you know, listening to it also helps. But in this case, listening to it and reading it and trying to decide which parts were important to me, not just trying to echo back Tolstoy. So if you go to read it, it will be different. But I wanted to get the essence of what I thought the story was about. So there was a lot of, you know, kind of ruminating. My husband can tell you I kind of go into a a state. writing, you know, doing cartoons of the scenes, you know. I'm sure you guys have done that to kind of remember what a story is about, or to create a new story. You know, lots of different ways of trying to get the story internalized. And then you have to say it out loud. I'm sure you know this. You know, you have to hear it. And you have to see what kind of comes out on the tongue, you know. And some things stay. And some things are like, "Ooh, that sounds terrible," you know. You kind of have to throw that out. So,
any other questions, comments?
Just a word of gratitude. Thank you so much. And the humming in between was a very nice touch, because you can imagine them humming as they're working or as they're walking, and it does open up a space just to hear and feel what they're feeling. So thank you.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Yeah, that's it's a lot of words. All right, do we have another? Yeah.
Yes, thank you so much. I'm just curious how many stories you have memorized and if you have to refresh them or when you go to tell another one, if they kind of come back to you.
So I don't have a count, because what's happened over the many years that I've learned stories is that some have stayed and some have kind of gone by the wayside. What I have discovered in recent years is the power of Zoom, because I can practice a story, do a video of it, and then listen to it again. And when I listen to it, it comes back. So that helps me refresh it. I like to learn new stories, but I have a kind of a clutch of old favorites that I guess I would say maybe about a half dozen that even if I didn't refresh them, I guess I've told them so often that I think I could just tell them. But that's only because I've told them so many times over the years. Yeah, so it's kind of a little bit of both.
Thank you, Maria. So I've heard you in several venues and enjoy every single one, but I am starting to notice a theme about pilgrimage. Mm-hmm. And I know that I believe you've made a pilgrimage, right?
I'm planning.
Planning your pilgrimage.
In April to do the 100 miles of the Camino to right. Compostela. So that is a reason why this story really resonated. Yeah.
And I'm wondering if you have noticed this theme or intentionally focused on this theme.
You know, that is really interesting, because recently, in thinking about the story and preparing, I thought to myself, well, you know, I've been telling journey stories forever. You know, it is a theme that I seem to gravitate toward over and over again. With this particular story, I had proposed it long before I signed up to do the Camino. And it was like, oh, okay, so this is part of the process. And it was a happy coincidence that the two met. Yes, but it is kind of my theme, you're right. Thanks.
Thank you for your story. Mm-hmm. I read it this past year because pilgrimage is of interest to myself as well. I don't know if you know our church. Some of the kids will be walking on the Camino this summer. So.
I did not know that. Yes.
And I especially liked how you presented it, because some of my friends, some of us who can't all go on pilgrimage in a physical way, like some of us get to do, it's an important realization just of how to pilgrimage in place. And so I just wanted to say I love how it connects. There's importance in being able to go on a pilgrimage and come back and use what you've learned, and also for people who go physically on the pilgrimage to just think about what you've presented today. So, yeah, thank you.
Thank you. And on that theme of pilgrimage in place, I am very interested in labyrinths, and Nassau Presbyterian hosts a labyrinth during reunions in your chapel, the Niles Chapel, which I have enjoyed over several years. And that is a way to pilgrimage in place. Labyrinth was kind of developed when, in the Middle Ages, well, this particular labyrinth that Nassau Presbyterian has, that style of labyrinth was developed when people could not get to the Holy Land. And so you would walk this journey in its place. So I encourage you all, during reunions, if you can, to come and do a labyrinth. There is a classical labyrinth here in town behind Fellowship and Prayer. It's a different a labyrinth, but if you can't wait till reunions, you might want to try that one out.
Thank you, Maria Lobiondra. Let's give another hand for Maria.
Thank you.
Next Sunday, our fourth Sunday in Advent, we will have Karen Rohrer with us. She is the Associate Academic Dean at Princeton Seminary, and she will be sharing with us her thoughts on attention as a pathway to hope. She has invited us to bring in a poem, image, or story that speaks to hope. We hope you'll join us. Thank you.